Does this sound familiar? Copyright, trademark, patents. I don't want to mess with all that legal stuff. I just want to write my code, or post to my blog, or upload to YouTube, or use some music for background songs on my webpage. Well, in the real world, you have to be concerned with the legality of using other people's intellectual property and in protecting your own. In this podcast, intellectual property expert John Cunniff will explain, in layman's terms, what these legal terms mean and what you need to know and do with them. By the way, this podcast is copyright 2008 by Dan Hansen, the Great Lakes Geek, trademark. Coming to you from the world-renowned Magnum Building on beautiful Payne Avenue in the heart of Cleveland, Ohio, it's the entrepreneur himself, Dan Hansen, bringing you the Great Lakes Geek Show. Today's guest is John J. Cunniff, an attorney with Hahn Lozier. John focuses his practice in intellectual property and technology and patent, trademark, and copyright law. Good morning, John.
Morning, Dan.
John, let's start off with a basic. How do you define intellectual property?
Well, intellectual property is basically property that's based on thought, products of the mind. So that includes copyright, which covers works of authorship. It involves trademarks, which are words, signs, or devices that indicate source. And it obviously also includes patents, which cover inventions.
Hey, let's drill down a little on some of these, because there is some seems to be some overlapping or confusion to a layperson.
Right.
For example, with a copyright, if I were to publish something to my blog or website, is it automatically copyrighted, or would I need to do post a copyright notice or fill out a legal form, or what would I need to do?
Well, you automatically have a copyright in any type of work of authorship, what the government calls a work of authorship, and that would include a blog or a web page that you write. The copyright attaches once you put that in tangible form. So whether you're writing a blog or the great American novel, once it's in tangible form, you have a copyright in that work. However, there are definitely advantages to registering a copyright. Namely, you need to have a registration actually issue on a copyrighted work in order to bring suit for copyright infringement.
How long does a copyright last? I mean, one of the questions that always come up is if with a blog or a web page it's always changing, and say I posted something last year, does that copyright carry through to this year, or how long does it last?
Well, technically you would have a copyright that for each derivative work, part of what a copyright is the right to distribute copies. Obviously, you're doing that automatically with a web page, but also to make derivative works. So if you modify your web page, it would cover each and every individual modification that you actually make. Now, you're not necessarily going to want to register each individual version of your web page, because even when you make, say, a typographical error that you change, that's obviously not going to be terribly cost-effective for you to register. But periodic re-registrations might be of use for a good number of people who engage in commerce on the web.
Now, okay, that's copyright, and I think we've got a grasp on the basics there. Trademark, when I think of trademark, I think of the Browns logo or something like that. Give us an example or drill down a little on what a trademark is and what that protects.
Well, a trademark is a word, a symbol, or a device that indicates source. So if you are at the grocery store, let's say you're in the checkout line and you want a candy bar and you grab what you think is a Hershey bar, well, you don't really sit down and say, okay, now is that really a Hershey bar? You make an impulse purchase. You base it on what the package looks like, the size, the shape, the color, and you just, oh, it's a Hershey bar. So that's part of what a trademark is. It's not just the name. It can be the shape of a product, that can be part of the trade dress of a product, which is also protectable. The name, a color, the pink color of Owens Corning fiberglass insulation. Yeah. Pink fiberglass doesn't make any difference on the insulating quality of fiberglass. It works just as well with yellow fiberglass as pink fiberglass. So that pink color, because it was used exclusively over a period of time, became a trademark. It indicated source, and that source was the Owens Corning Company. So there are other things that can become trademarks. The NBC chimes can be a trademark. There are a number of different things that can be a trademark. It's not just necessarily a word or a slogan.
Okay, very good. Now, for some of us who blog and do websites and all, you'll often see, you know, say, we'll use the word Microsoft, and then there'll be a circle with a TM or an R or something in that. Should we be including that to be good trademark and copyright citizens, or what's the point of those little circled marks?
Well, for copyright, again, you don't need a notice for copyright to actually attach now. It used to be the case that you needed to provide notice in order for your right to vest in that copyright, but that is no longer the case. But it is good practice to include a copyright notice, and that can include a C within a circle, or it can actually, you can actually use the words copyright, John Doe, and the year, to show that you claim copyright in this work. It's also advantageous in other countries if you're going to be selling a product, say a book or a magazine article or something like that overseas. Not every country will recognize a copyright without a copyright notice. Most do, but not all of them. For a trademark, the R within a circle is used to designate trademarks that are registered with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. That should not be used if you do not have an actual registration. It shouldn't be used if you have a pending application for registration either. It should only be used when you have an issued registration. What you can use in the meantime, if you have an application pending, or if you're not even going to file for a registration federally, say you're only selling your goods or services within the state of Ohio or within your home state, then you would use the TM just as a notice to others that you do claim this as a trademark, as your source identifier.
I guess the third main legal method to protect intellectual property is, of course, the patent. And what is the patent?
Well, a patent is an exclusive right that is given to inventors for a term of up to 20 years from the date of filing of a patent application. It is a right to exclude. It's a right to keep other people from practicing your invention. So if you have a new invention that is, it's novel, it's non-obvious, and it has utility, then those are the basic requirements for a patent, for an invention to be patentable. It has to be novel. It has to be something that's brand new. It can't be something that was known and then forgotten about in the industry for a while and then rediscovered. Sometimes it does happen that we'll have a piece of prior art, say a very old patent, that will come up, and it will surprise an inventor that, no one has ever done this before. I'm surprised. Unfortunately, in that kind of a situation, your invention's not patentable because it's really a rediscovery. It's not something that's new. There's also a requirement that an invention be non-obvious. So if you're making very simple changes to something that already exists, and the result is something that's basically predictable, that's not going to be patentable either. And then the last basic requirement, utility, your invention actually has to do what you say it does. The patent office isn't going to give patents on perpetual motion machines or things like that.
No alchemy, huh?
No alchemy at all.
Okay. You know, in your technology practice, what kind of tech do you see the most requests for? Is it IT? Is it biotech? Is it a mix? What do you see?
Well, we see a broad variety of different technology areas. Of course, in this area, polymer science is big, whether that's tire production or in tire inventions. But we do see an increasing amount of biotech, biomedical inventions. So it really runs the gamut.
Now, if an individual or a business has a unique idea or invention, what steps should they take, either alone, what can they do alone, or when should they go to an attorney who specializes in this, if there's some kind of rule of thumb?
Well, the very first thing they should do is they should document their idea or their invention. And by documenting, what is best is if a laboratory technician or an engineer has an actual laboratory notebook, one that is filled out regularly every day, that describes the invention, that is signed and dated by the inventor, and also witnessed by someone, preferably who does not claim co-inventorship with the inventor. That way, there is a date of invention that is documentable. If there is an argument, say, in a fast-moving area, you can very easily have two different groups of people who are working in an area, and they arrive at basically the same invention at roughly the same time. In that situation, because U.S. patent law awards a patent to the first to invent, provided that they were diligent in reducing an idea to practice and pursuing a patent application, they will be awarded the patent first. It is not necessarily, as it is in some other countries, most other countries actually, that whoever gets to the patent office door first is the one who is given a patent. So documentation is very important, especially in the United States.
Speaking of the United States, this is a global economy, and the internet is certainly no boundaries. How does having protection of your intellectual property via United States law protect us internationally?
Well, all intellectual property law is going to be dependent on the individual country you're speaking about. A U.S. patent will allow you to prevent others from making, using, or selling your invention within the United States or its territories. It also prevents the importation of your invention into the United States. But beyond the United States borders, it really does not it has limited value. Now, there are exceptions. The famous BlackBerry case, where part of the process occurred across the border in Canada. But in general, U.S. patent law will only apply within the boundaries of the United States. In the same way, if you are selling a product, a patented product in Canada, you would want a Canadian patent in order to secure your rights there, and the same with other regions and countries.
You know, I would think that with this age of specialization, it would be very difficult for a patent office to have staff people who can really understand a lot of the things that are going on in bio and polymers and IT and all. How do they manage to look at what an engineer submits to them and determine if it's new or unique and all the qualifications for a patent?
Well, staffing is a continuing challenge for the patent office. There's no doubt about that. They have a very long backlog of applications current, and they don't really see an end in sight in that backlog. However, the patent office does classify inventions according to their own classification system, somewhat in the same way that a public library will classify books in their collection, and they hire patent examiners based on those technology areas. So the examiner should have a basic understanding of, say, a biotech invention in that area, in that art group, or polymer science, or mechanical inventions, electrical inventions. They will hire different people in different disciplines to handle those applications.
You know, this has got to be a golden era for you guys with the internet and YouTube and some of these things that didn't exist before. There's all kinds of new copyright issues and concerns coming along now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's big, and it's always getting bigger, it seems.
You know, I ran into one myself. Let me just close with this example, and maybe you can point out where the problem was. I was at the Oktoberfest this summer at Berea Fairgrounds, and there was a strolling band of guys with a trombone and accordion who had obviously been sampling the Oktoberfest beer, and I videotaped them playing a Van Morrison song, Brown Eyed Girl. So I put it up on YouTube. It was funny, and it got some hits, and Next day I got a, hey, you've got to remove that. That's Van Morrison's song. Even though it was a very, no one ever said, you know, it was Brown Eyed Girl or it's just a some strolling guys playing that song. And they requested to have that removed.
That's right. That's right. Unfortunately, that would be an unauthorized reproduction of that song. Copyright would attach to the words and the music. So whether it's a band that's strolling around and it's nothing but instrumental music rather than the words themselves and the music, that is still technically a copyright violation if you don't have permission to post that.
Well, I'll tell you, John, I think you finally cleared up a lot of these issues for me. I know, listeners, he's probably helped you too. John is listed in the Great Lakes Geek Speakers Bureau, so if you need his expertise for your company or if you have an event where you'd like John to speak, please contact us and we'll see what we can do. Today we've been speaking with John J. Cunniff of Hahn Lozier. John's an expert in intellectual property and technology and patent, trademark, and copyright law. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Dan.
You've been listening to the Great Lakes Geek Show. Come back soon at www.greatlakesgeek.com.